Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
now
we're gonna have a solar-topia.
Started to burn too many things we found. This Harvey Wasserman, Sluggo Harvey Wasserman, at the Solartopia show on PRN FM. Back for another hour in the great land of renewable energy and social justice and the end to nuclear power. We got a lot of really important stuff to talk about today. We are seeing a flood, the trickle of reactor shutdowns turning into a flood of shutdowns. And we got two or three great people to talk about, people right at the cutting edge of all this stuff. Kevin Camps, are you with us?
Hey, Harvey, I'm here.
Okay, my man. Tim Judson?
Yeah, here, Harvey.
Okay, and Jessica. Did Jessica join us? Jessica Azoulay? Well, she's working on a legal memo, I think. We can more than carry it. I'd love to have her on if she calls in, and we'll deal with this. So what's happening, guys, despite the worst efforts of the madman in the White House, is that we're seeing a major turning point now in the history of atomic energy in this country and in the world. And stuff that we have been wanting to say for years and years and years is now starting to happen, in that we're getting a major flood of reactor shutdowns. There are just two commercial atomic plants left under construction in the United States, and that much is very tentative. The two reactors at Vogtle in Georgia, where the builder, Westinghouse, has gone bankrupt, and the PUC and the general public in Georgia is starting to realize what an incredible financial catastrophe they're looking at with Volta. We're starting to talk about two reactors coming in at about $25 billion, if it's even that low. But then beyond that, we've got a whole wave of shutdowns. And let's start with the two that are nearest and dearest to my physical survival, since I'm in Los Angeles, which is Diablo Canyon, where I spent three lovely nights in the county jail in 1984. And now it looks like we've got the possibility of an accelerated shutdown. Which one of you two guys wants to start talking about Diablo? Tim, Kevin?
I could just briefly describe happened out there. Myself and Diane DiRigo from Nuclear Information and Resource Service spoke at the invitation of the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, and that was on January 19th, and the focus was radioactive waste issues. And I covered transportation risks, things like barge shipments from Diablo down the coast to Oxnard and what could go wrong with that. And Diane spoke about the proposed centralized interim storage facilities targeted at Texas and New Mexico, and also the Yucca Mountain, Nevada permanent burial dump that's proposed right now on Capitol Hill. And what was interesting
about
timing was...
The dump is going to be on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, it should be, right?
I couldn't...
All the great decisions get made. Well, the California Public Utility Commission just days earlier had issued a ruling that... allows for Diablo Canyon Units 1 and 2 to shut down at the end of their 40-year license. Hopefully, they will shut down sooner than that. But they also ruled that this proposal, that some hundreds of millions of dollars, I don't remember the exact amount, of ratepayer funding could flow to the host communities, could flow to the workforce in certain regards in terms of retraining. And that was a part of a package deal agreed to by the unions at the plant, by the company itself, Pacific Gas and Electric, and by a small number of environmental groups. Well, the CPUC agreed with the shutdown plan, but they did not agree to the externalities of the impacts on the local communities. So there's still a lot of fight to be had out there. The Mothers for Peace is not a party to that shutdown agreement. So their gloves are off, and they want that plant shut down as soon as possible, not 2025, which is the official shutdown date, but more near term than that.
Yeah, and Tim, do you want to jump in on that, Tim Judson? I should invite Tim Judson.
Yeah, I mean, I think the agreement, as you know, as Kevin laid out, still stands, and the PSC has approved for Diablo to close, you know, in 2024 and 2025. You know, when its licenses expire. But I think it's still very much an open question whether PG&E, you know, would decide to close the reactors early or earlier than that. And, you know, what the key piece to this, and this is actually at least what PG&E said its reason was for agreeing to shut down the nukes, is that, you know, what they found when they started looking at, how California's energy picture is going to be shaping up over the next 10 years, is that, you know, renewable energy is growing so fast in California, and especially solar, that, you know, by 2024 and 2025, it was going to become really complicated to manage the grid with Diablo Canyon running, with all the solar that's expected to be online. There's going to be just too much power on the grid at various points, you know, with the amount of solar that's going up. And it was going to be really inefficient to keep Diablo going. And that's the reason that PG&E says it wants to shut Diablo down, is because it's just going to become uneconomical to manage the energy supply. And, you know, depending on how quickly solar grows in California, it could push that horizon, you know, much closer to now, basically.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing situation. So I'm sitting here 5 hours downwind from Diablo Canyon. And my understanding is this, that okay, you had this deal that was cut a year. It's about a year ago, I think. Yeah, maybe a little more.
Almost 2 years ago, actually.
2 years ago.
It's three. God, time flies.
I think so. It was June of 2016 that they announced it.
When was it?
June of 2016.
All right, so it's 2.5 years. So it's not even. Yeah, it's a year and a half. So the scope of the deal, which involved the unions, basically IBEW, isn't it, the guys at the plant, and there are what, about 900 workers at Diablo. Maybe it's more like 1,200, the double reactor. So the union agreed with the communities, the communities that are getting tax breaks from Diablo. And the state was involved, and two environmental groups, NRDC and Friends of the Earth, right?
Yeah.
And they agreed that there'd be about $1.3 billion in tax and rate hikes allowed to the utility. In exchange, a fair amount of that money would go to the communities to compensate them for the loss of the tax revenue. There would be a retain and retrain program for the workers at the plant. And there would also be funding for PG&E to ease into a supplementing the power, actually substituting the power from Diablo with renewables. And the plant, then in exchange, PG&E offered to not pursue a renewal of their license, for the two reactors, which is expired 2024 and 2025. Am I missing anything? Is that you guys understanding?
That's about right.
Yeah,
I think the funding flow was going to be towards efficiency under the agreement, and that's another thing that the CPUC disallowed to happen.
Yeah.
Okay. So then, what happened was there was an administrative law judge, Peter V. Allen. And I have posted his decision, or his recommendation, actually. His recommendation was not a definitive decision. It was a recommendation to the PUC, but with a lot of weight. I mean, if they put in an administrative law judge, they're going to pay attention to his decision. So Peter V. Allen came in and did an extremely thorough job. And he put out a memo or a decision a couple months ago, which I posted at nukefree.org. And you can read his decision at nukefree.org. And in this decision, he said that instead of $1.3 billion, that PG&E should get $300 million. And he disallowed the payment of subsidies to the towns that were going to lose their tax revenue, saying basically this was not the ratepayers' responsibility. He did allow some of the money for the retain and retrain program, and he also disallowed a lot of the money for the transitional costs of getting to efficiency and renewables. And essentially, he cut the he recommended that instead of $1.3 billion in additional money for the ratepayers, the PG&E only get $300 million, which is a shocking decision. Now, of course, he didn't say the PG&E couldn't cover those other costs with stockholder money. All he said was that the Utilities Commission should not allow this kind of rate hike. And it was a stunner. And then it went to the PUC itself, and the PUC essentially adopted most of his recommendations. I think they added in some money for the retain and retrain. There was a little more. They recommended a little higher rate hike than Peter V. Allen recommended, and they approved that. So that's official, and it's not. I don't believe that it's appealable. I don't think that PG&E can appeal that decision by the PUC. So PG&E now, and they haven't said anything since, they had agreed to set the plants by 2024 and 2025. They have not now said anything about shutting them earlier. But as far as I'm concerned, and Kevin, you were just in San Luis Obispo, and I've had this from the mothers, Linda Seeley and Jane Swanson, that it really does not pay PG&E to continue to operate the two reactors. Because as you said, Tim, and actually the first time I've heard that, it's a very interesting discussion, that the grid itself, given the flood of renewables coming online in California, which I don't think will be significantly affected by the Trump tariff. I mean, it'll hurt a little bit, but nobody's going to stop with solar now. And the amount of tariff that Trump wants to put on will be exceeded by the savings in the continued efficiency, rise in efficiency in solar panels. I think that's pretty clear. So if, as you said, Tim, if the flood of renewables continues into the grid, PG&E is not going to really be able to manage the grid if they also have this 24/7 flow of extraneous electrons coming from Diablo. Is that essentially you guys' understanding?
Yeah, and I think Harvey, you know, in fact, I mean, you know, I haven't looked at it in detail, and it's hard to really understand, you know, on the face of it. But you know, one of the things that PG&E is concerned about, and actually it's pretty clear that they're concerned about it from some of the things that were written into the closure agreement, is, you know, how quickly you know, communities opting to go solar, you know, en masse in California could actually completely disrupt the whole energy picture in the state. And what PG&E was, you know, expressed a lot of concern about is that, you know, that so many communities may opt to go solar, that it may, you know, that it may actually push so much solar online that, you know, that that, you know, that Diablo you know, becomes inefficient to operate much sooner. And so, yeah, in fact, you know, and so, you know, my guess is that there are things that the PG&E is trying to bake into its plans that would actually make it, you know, a little bit harder for communities to go solar. And you know, and there may be some things in this decision that actually, you know, kind of take some of those hurdles away.
Well, in reading between the lines, you could say that if PG&E is stuck with Diablo, they're going to miss out on having a role to play in the solarization of the rest of the state. I mean,
I think that was one of the things that the judge decided was that, you know, the way that they were trying to build, the PG&E was trying to build energy efficiency and whatnot into this closure agreement, was actually going to be sort of profiteering. And, you know, and so the decision to, you know, to disallow that, you know, was actually one to protect the ratepayers from, you know, PG&E gouging them for, you know, for energy efficiency projects.
Yeah. So, Tim, did you want to jump in on that? No. Okay. So,
Kevin, I was just going to add, you know, to keep in mind as we talk about electricity and the money, that a really good reason to shut Diablo sooner rather than later are the safety risks. So a big, bad earthquake out there. It's surrounded by earthquake fault lines. Another issue I brought up when I spoke out in San Luis Obispo was that Diablo Canyon is on a couple short lists you don't want to be on. One is one of the worst embrittled reactor pressure vessels in the country. I believe that's at Unit 1 at Diablo. And another one is a leaking high-level radioactive waste storage pool. And that's another reason to shut down sooner rather than later, is you don't want to keep making 20 metric tons of irradiated nuclear fuel per reactor per year if you can avoid that, because we have no solution for that forever deadly waste.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
and let's not confuse PG&E's reasons for, you know, for agreeing to shut Diablo with the real reasons that the, you know, the environmental groups, you know, made the issue happen, which is, you know, which is fundamentally about the safety risks.
And of course, these guys never ever want to discuss safety risks. You never hear them admitting to it. But of course, and just to throw something in here, you know, the two words San Andreas don't seem to enter the dialogue when you have PG&E at the table. I watched the entire movie. It's one of the worst cinematic experiences of my life. This movie, San Andreas, with Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson, where they portrayed the San Andreas going off and destroying Los Angeles, putting San Francisco like 20 feet underwater. And this whole god-awful 90 or 120-minute movie about this earthquake destroying California never once mentions the word nuclear power. And, you know, you would, to watch the movie, you would never think that there were reactors in California 45 miles from the San Andreas. And I guarantee you, if the if an earthquake happened, there was anything like the one portrayed in the movie, Diablo would be a pile of rubble. And the cloud would have long since completely irradiated Los Angeles. And I got to throw in here, I just read a very disturbing article yesterday online about the radiation levels in Tokyo downwind from Fukushima. And there is starting to be a tremendous backlog of anecdotal evidence that people are really suffering in Tokyo from radioactive exposure, especially children. And having been to Three Mile Island a year after the accident there, this is really, really disturbing to me. And I'm sure to everybody, and it's not something that we can run away from, especially with the Olympics coming to Japan, which is utterly insane. If anybody listening in is contemplating going to the Japan Olympics, don't. It's just a nightmare. Okay, so I also wanted to throw in a pet suggestion came to me from Tom Campbell, the great rock and roll promoter from the And No Nukes concerts. He long ago suggested, and I'd love to see this happen, that we cover the California Aqueduct. It's about 400 miles long, and it's not like a straight channel. It's all over the map, but that we cover the California Aqueduct with solar panels, and that you can actually float them, and it has a synergistic effect, because solar panels actually work better when they're cooler. That's why Colorado is such a great state. They have 300 days of sun, but it's cold there, and the PV is actually more efficient in the colder weather. So I was told a story. I haven't looked it up yet, but my source was pretty reliable, that there was a giant coal mine.
And let alone, Harvey, that the aqueduct might lose a lot less water to evaporation as it's going through that sun.
Well, it's actually, yes, it's a very big percentage. Actually, I was told it's as much as 40%. Of the water in the aqueduct evaporates. And so that's a huge factor here. So if we covered the California aqueduct with floating solar panels and just run a power line down the aqueduct to a big battery bank, this could be a huge deal. So there's a governor's race this year and Senate race, and I've met a couple of the candidates, and we're going to start pushing that. That'll be the new Diablo, you know, the Diablo Canyon Memorial Solar power line. It would be a great thing. Okay, so I'm betting that we're going to hear soon, hopefully sooner rather than later, from PG&E They're going to, you know, try and gouge as much as they possibly can. But I'm going to bet, and you hear it here first, that Diablo Canyon, both reactors, will be shut by 2021. Do you guys think that's reasonable?
Harvey, my money's always with you.
Well, I'll give you my address. You can send me the check.
That's the good thing about solar and wind and efficiency is it's very rapidly deployed. While, you know, new nuclear would take forever to get done, and the climate crisis would have come and gone by the time nuclear showed up at the starting line.
Yeah, you know, and I'm starting to, you know, Bill McKibben's stuff, there was a time when he would talk about nuclear, but he is emphasizing the, you know, he's the great guru now of global warming, and he's emphasizing the need for speed. And the last thing on earth you want to do is start building new nuclear plants, and let alone keeping the old ones operating. So the sooner we get these two, then, of course, California will be nuclear-free. I do want to mention one other thing. There hasn't been a real significant movement to shut the three nukes at Palo Verde outside of Phoenix. But they are partly owned by the DWP of Los Angeles, the Department of Water and Power. And as we now hopefully bring Diablo down and make California nuclear free, we're going to really have to focus on this triple reactor thing in Arizona. We haven't had a whole lot of grassroots action there in Arizona. Maybe you guys know more than me, but these three reactors need to go, and LA does have some skin in the game.
Yeah, it's the biggest nuclear plant in the country by megawattage. It's three reactors, 1,200 megawatts electric each, so it's the single biggest nuclear power plant in the U.S., Palo Verde.
Yeah, and cooled by wastewater. You know, when you flush your toilet, you help cool the Palo Verde reactors, so we're going to have to jump in on them. Okay, let's jump over now. And one thing I also have to throw in a caveat here. I mean, we are starting to really enjoy discussing the dynamics of getting these old reactors down. It's something we've worked on for 30 to 40 years. And, you know, the idea that San Onofre and all these other reactors are already shut is deeply gratifying. But I got to mention, you know, the bad news that China is, after a brief hiatus after Fukushima, to recalibrate or whatever they did, is continuing to build 20 reactors. They already have 35, so they're going to be up to 55, and we don't see any evidence that they're turning away from nuclear. At least I haven't. Maybe you guys have. And, of course, you know, they're moving ahead with solar, which is great, and with wind, which is great, but they seem to be persisting with their plans for nuclear power plants, and this is not reassuring, I got to tell you. You guys know anything
about
China?
One aspect of that, situation too, is with China
during the Obama years,
certainly
the NRC chairman, FERC chairman Wellinghoff went to China on a reactor construction site tour. AP1000s, the Toshiba Westinghouse design, was being built at multiple sites in China. And apparently what they saw shocked them in terms of the shortcuts on safety, the quality assurance violations. Not that they ever publicly spoke about that or disclosed it to the American people, but the fear was, you know, after Fukushima happened, that given the shortcuts being taken in China, the next disaster to watch out for is when they start firing up these reactors that they've thrown up in a great big hurry.
Yeah, and if there's an accident in China, the only way we're going to find out about it is when the radioactive cloud is discovered in Sweden or someplace like that. Tim, did you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, like everything with China, it's complicated. But I think that, you know, they're continuing to, you know, to talk about moving ahead with their nuclear plans and whatnot. But they're also, you know, behind schedule and behind their targets in terms of building nukes. And, you know, and the amount of their investment is going so heavily in, you know, in favor of renewables right now. That, you know, I mean, my sense is that there's going to be a reckoning with, you know, within China about the wisdom of going forward with this. And, you know, especially now that, you know, there's been more delays, you know, in the French reactors that they're building and, you know, and probably some problems with the Westinghouse reactors as well. You know, so my sense is that, you know, China's nuclear plans are a problem, but they're also an exception, I think.
Well, let's hope. You know, I mean, I'm terrified by the prospect of all these reactors coming along in China, and God knows what the status of the 35 that they have operating there. I mean, geez. The thought of 35 operating reactors in China is just horrifying to me. At least in France, they're starting openly to move down, to shut them down, and to get back towards a renewable future. And of course, Germany is going to be nuke free in 2022. So, but China is really the only country that has any substantial number of reactors under construction. And God help us, that's all I can say. So, of course, I have heard that there is an anti-nuclear movement in China. We all assume that China is a totalitarian state and that nobody can speak out. But, given what's going on with Trump, we have no reason to be particularly smug about that compared to our own freedoms of speech here. So just got to keep that in mind. I don't know. I haven't seen much about the Russians building reactors. They don't seem to have the money for it. They didn't have a deal at some point to build, I think, a reactor or two in the United Arab Emirates. Now there's an idea for you, a Russian reactor in the UAE. But have you guys heard of other foreign?
They're actually one of the worst actors on the international nuclear development scene right now. In fact, Russia has been lobbying more intensely than anyone else, or Rosatom, the Russian nuclear corporation, has. For subsidies under the Paris Climate Agreement and the Green Climate Fund. And there's actually been a lot of news about a fairly dirty deal that they're at the center of in terms of building nukes in Saudi Arabia. Also American interests involved as well, but it's Russian reactors that they're talking about building.
Well, that's a part of the Michael Flynn scandal that there has been some media about, Newsweek for one, that made that tie between Michael Flynn and those Russian nuclear establishment efforts in the Middle East. And I remember Mohammed El-Baradei, when he was still serving as director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, he received the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to prevent war in Iraq and Iran. And his point was the only reason that a dozen Arab countries, were flirting with the idea of nuclear power was to give themselves a pathway to nuclear weapons if they chose to do that someday. And yeah, he's from Egypt, so he would know. So that's another part of the world that really does not need reactors in any way, shape, or form. Just the conventional military risks, like Bennett Ramberg warned about way back in 1984, nuclear power plants as weapons for the enemy in a conventional war. Talk about dirty bombs if they get blown up.
Yeah, God. All right, so let's move back to friendlier territory here. We have two batches of four reactors each that could be in the short-term range for shutdown. First Energy, the abominable utility based in Akron, owns the Perry and the Davis-Stussy reactors in Ohio and the two at the Beaver Valley in Pennsylvania. Kevin, do you want to run through the situation, and then Tim, jump in on what's happening with First Energy and those reactors?
Sure, yeah. The Cleveland Plain Dealer broke the story several days ago now, and the Toledo Blade has jumped in, and the Columbus Dispatch. But, you know, First Energy lobbyists for many years now have been trying to get large-scale subsidies out of the state legislature in Ohio. They've been very active on the federal level, like with the Rick Perry coal and nuclear bailout proposal. First Energy was very active on that campaign to get that money. So they've been trying to grab money from any public source that they could think of for years now. And what just got reported is that some hedge funds have jumped into the fray. So $2.5 billion in hedge fund money to try to rescue First Energy from itself and prevent bankruptcy. And apparently April is going to be a big decision-making month for First Energy as to whether the reactors you named, Harvey, Davis-Bessey and Perry and Beaver Valley Units 1 and 2, will remain operating, will be shut down. There's also some coal plants in the mix where shutdown decisions could get made depending on how it goes. And yet again, sound like a broken record here, but I always like to bring up the fact that Davis-Bessey, for one, which also has a reactor pressure vessel embrittlement problem, has had more close calls with catastrophe than maybe any other single reactor in the world. And in addition to that, has a negligible to non-existent containment because of the severe cracking of the shield building that gets worse with every freeze-thaw cycle at the site, which happens many times each year. And then for its part, Beaver Valley in Pennsylvania, one of the units there, I think it's Unit 1, is also on that short list of five worst embrittled reactor pressure vessels in the country. So for the safety reasons alone, these reactors should be shut down, let alone their economic freefall.
Okay, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as ever, I would second Kevin on that. The interesting thing about what's happening with First Energy is, you know, that it's actually, you know, it also involves their reactors in Pennsylvania as well, the Beaver Valley 1 and 2 reactors. And, you know, First Energy has been, you know, out front pushing for bailouts, you know, in Ohio and at other levels for 4 years now. And at every turn, it's sort of blown up in their face. And I think they're up to a day of reckoning with their investors and with their lenders right now about what's going to happen. And, you know, it's very possible that First Energy could be making closure announcements on all four of those nukes as well as some coal plants in the next few months. It would be sort of a stunning turnaround, but I think it's emblematic of what's going on in the utility industry nationwide, which is that, you know, they've been, you know, companies like First Energy and Exelon have been trying to, you know, to sort of, you know, prop up the energy status quo for years now. And, you know, and it may be, you know, the sort of the game may be, you know, may be up soon for that, for those kind of, you know, for that agenda.
Well, I want to point out also, having been an Ohioan for 50 years or so, first of all, that the legislature in Ohio, which is completely corrupt, and you know, it's the night of the living dead in there. The joke in Ohio is that in order to get into the state legislature, you have to have a lobotomy. But these guys did not vote to bail out First Energy. I mean, if you'd given me odds 4 years ago, I would have said, you know, 90% that they're going to give First Energy whatever they want. And they've had, as you said, they've been in there banging for 4 years to get massive bailouts, and they haven't gotten them, which is astounding to me. And it's a total tribute to the power of the anti-nuclear movement and grassroots organizing that the Ohio legislature has not bailed out First Energy at Perry and Davis Bessie. And then, of course, you know, the two in Pennsylvania just come along for the ride. Doesn't First Energy also own TMI Unit 1?
No, that's Exelon.
Oh, okay. All right, so we are looking. And the other interesting thing is that the hedge funds that are coming in to take over First Energy want the reactors shut. I mean, usually when guys with big bucks come in the past, they've always, you know, wanted the reactors to keep operating. So they must really be losing a ton of money at these four reactors if the guys with the deep pockets are coming in and saying, well, we're going to take you over, but you got to shut these reactors. That's a new turn.
I think we have to be vigilant, though, because with that inflow of, or that influx of $2.5 billion, it could breathe new life into this lobbying effort. And like you said, Harvey, you can't trust the Ohio legislature as far as you can throw it. So we're going to have to stay vigilant until it's done because, I mean, we've suffered incredible reversals in places like New York and Illinois where reactor shutdown dates were put forward, and it was merely a bait and switch. It was used as leverage to secure massive ratepayer bailouts. We just saw it in Michigan at Palisades, where a date certain for shutdown was named, October 1st, 2018, and then all of a sudden, the company didn't get the full amount of bailout that it was requesting to execute, in this particular case, execute the shutdown, and they said, okay, forget about it. We're not shutting down. We're going to keep sailing ever deeper into uncharted risk territory. So we have to stay vigilant until the bitter end on these things.
God, it's frustrating. It's really, really mind-boggling. And Davis Bessie is absolutely terrifying. I mean, that thing is just, you know, I used to own old Volkswagens, and man, you know, I had the floorboards were rusted out. It was like barely a step above a motorcycle. And that Davis Bessie, I mean, the containment, the so-called containment there is a liability. Right, Kevin? I mean, you've written more than anybody about this. That thing could just fall in and cause a meltdown.
Well, that's the incredible thing was we had been fighting the license extension, and the 40-year initial license expired on Earth Day 2017 for a twist of irony. So it, at the very latest, should have shut on Earth Day 2017, 40 years of operations. But the NRC rubber-stamped a 20-year extension at this most dangerous plant. And in the very final stages of that license extension approval, First Energy finally told the truth, and they told the Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards at NRC headquarters that they'd known from the beginning of the cracking issue back in October 2011 that large chunks of concrete could spall off the exterior face of the shield building, fall down onto safety-significant system structures, components below, and disrupt cooling to the core. And so in that sense, the cracked containment could cause the meltdown that it would then fail to contain. And despite all that, NRC is fine with operating as long as they want. It's just a question of, you know, can they afford to? That it's, NRC is not going to shut them down for safety risks.
Jeez, completely crazy. All right, we're talking with Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear and Tim Judson of Nuclear Information Resource, the two guys of service and two guys who know about, probably more than anything about this trail of reactor shutdowns. I do want to mention in Ohio, there's a particular situation. Northern Ohio is tremendously excellent for wind power. The winds are, it's not like the Dakotas where you get these, you know, constant gale force winds, but the winds are steady in Northern Ohio coming off the lake. The land is completely flat. It's all farmers who want these windmills. The sites are close to cities where the electricity will be consumed, and there's a total network of power lines there. You don't really have to build new power lines in Northern Ohio to bring in wind power, and there's a single sentence in the Ohio Code that describes a ridiculous and undoable setback where they want the windmill setback. I can't remember what it is, but it's like a quarter mile from the nearest road, which is insane. And they to justify this, they incite something called ice sling. And what happens is if it gets cold and the wind turbines aren't turning, ice will build up on the blades. And then when it gets down to around 32 and the blades start up, they'll fling the ice. And it can go pretty far. I mean, it's impressive, but there's no instance of anyone being harmed by ice sling, you know, as opposed to Chernobyl, Fukushima, and Three Mile Island. But the Ohio legislature has basically stopped $4 billion. I mean, these are signed contracts for $4 billion worth of wind power in Northern Ohio, which would completely replace Perry Davis Bessie and the two Beaver Valley reactors, because it goes into Pennsylvania, and create thousands more jobs than you got at the reactors. And they can't get this, you know, even Governor Kasich has wanted to get this thing out of the Ohio Code, and so far they haven't been able to do it. Now, there is another movement to do it, and hopefully we can do that. But anyone who says, oh, we're going to lose jobs because of shutting these four reactors, forget about it. I mean, wind power will take over. These guys are all ready to go. If they got this sentence out of the Ohio Code, this $4 billion would pour into Northern Ohio. And, you know, again, of course, there may be, as Tim mentioned about Diablo, there may be a subterranean reason that they don't want the grid to have all this influx of wind power as long as they still have the nukes online. So this is something to think about, that there's absolutely no reason why Ohio shouldn't become one of the most fertile territories in the world for wind power. You know, you've got all these perfect, it's a perfect storm. You couldn't invent a better spot for wind power unless the winds were maybe slightly stronger, but, you know, they're plenty strong enough. And of course, the world's best wind, you know, the strongest, steadiest, most powerful wind is in the middle of Lake Erie. It's level 7. And if you look at the wind maps, you see this dark purple or red, whatever is the current, you know, they're using there for wind power in Lake Erie. And that's been held back. And Lake Erie is actually really good for wind power. Again, it's not that far from the cities. It's doable now with floating windmills, which they've, even though it's not that shallow. And the only extraneous issue is ice in the middle of the winter, which could bump up against the towers. But
no big deal. All right, let's move on now. Tim, this is your territory, New York State. Cuomo, the governor, has set forth this insane bailout plan for four upstate reactors. You want to tell us what's going on there?
Sure. Well, you know, as your listeners have heard a number of times, it was about a year and a half ago that that Governor Cuomo rammed through this massive subsidy for four of the reactors in New York. It amounts to about $7.6 billion over the next 12 years. The subsidy started flowing last April, so there's about $360 million that ratepayers in New York have already paid to Exelon for these four reactors. But a number of organizations and dozens of individuals joined a lawsuit last year to try to get this decision overturned. There are really serious flaws in the way that the Public Service Commission, which is the agency that regulates utilities, passed this thing. With no notice, with complete sort of arbitrary, and capricious, sort of provisions to it. And the state and the power companies tried to have this case dismissed just summarily. And last week, the judge ruled in our favor, and the case is going to move forward to a hearing, where we actually have a chance to have this regulation repealed, and to stop these subsidies from happening. And if that were to happen, it's very like, if the subsidies were to get repealed and they're not able to get them reinstated, there's at least two reactors that could shut very soon in New York as well.
Wow, that's a huge deal. Kevin, you've been following this one?
Yeah, we were a tentative party to the lawsuit, but we did not establish standing, so we got chucked out by the judge. But we're very happy that NEERS and a number of grassroots groups in New York are still pursuing the case, and that it's going to be heard on the merits, and we can only hope for the best because, as much credit as Governor Cuomo deserves for the shutdown of Indian Point by date certain in just a few years, the raw political deal that was made to keep the upstate Lake Ontario shoreline reactors operating is most dangerous. These are some of the oldest reactors in the country. Lake Ontario is a major freshwater drinking water supply for, two countries, the U.S. and Canada. And I think folks in upstate New York are just as important as Manhattanites when it comes to their physical health and safety. So those reactors need to be shut down as soon as possible.
Of course, in the Trump era, the worth of a human being is decided by how much money they have in the bank. So, you got to have a caveat there. But, Tim, tell us, what court is hearing this? And is it a PUC decision that they would have to overturn? What are the legal technicalities here?
Yeah, sure. It's a good question, Harvey. I mean, we've been fighting bailouts, at the state and federal level, for the last 4 years. And it happens differently in every state. So like in Illinois, a year ago, it was the legislature that passed the nuclear bailout law. In New York, it happened by a regulation by the Public Utility Commission, or the Public Service Commission, as it's called there. In other states, it's happening by legislation. So, but in the case of New York, it was this agency decision. And even the legislature in New York has been furious about this. But it happened before anybody could react to it. And that's really the basis for the lawsuit, is that even the legislature, wasn't aware of what was going on, before the bailout was even approved.
Why did Cuomo do this? Has anybody talked to his shrink? I mean, why would he come forward with $7.5 billion for four ridiculous nukes upstate?
Well, I mean, in New York, New York is sort of a microcosm of the country. There's a real sharp political divide between North and South, and so the southern part of the state, especially New York City, is heavily Democratic. And the northern part of the state, central New York and western New York and those parts are heavily, more heavily Republican. And the governor, a lot of the sense was that it's, a lot of it was about politics. And the governor didn't want to go into the 2018 reelection campaign, with reactor closures and job losses hanging around his neck. And so, our sense was that this was ultimately a political decision about the optics of reactor closures in communities that are heavily Republican.
Oh, God. Isn't there a renewables industry in the upstate New York?
There is, and solar is growing quite a bit, and there's a lot of support for renewables in upstate New York, just like everywhere else. But there's also, like you pointed out in Ohio, there's also some resistance to renewable energy. Some of it probably being funded by right wing organizations like the Koch brothers, that have been stirring up astroturf or fake grassroots opposition to renewables, where they've passed local ordinances that put zoning restrictions, on how renewable energy can be developed and those sort of things, that have slowed down the pace of renewable energy development in New York for quite some time now. And so that was part of, that was one of the ways that the Governor Cuomo managed to get at least some acquiescence to the nuclear subsidies last year, was by packaging the nuclear subsidies with a big increase in the state's renewable energy standard up to 50% by 2030. And, there's some hope that the RPS is going to create, better incentives to be able to grow renewables in New York much faster than they have been.
Well, has he budged at all? I mean, is there any indication that the governor might be changing his mind?
He hasn't indicated any backing off on the nuclear subsidies, although he's been made pretty miserable about it, since the whole thing happened. In addition to the lawsuits that have been going on, there's been this incredible grassroots campaign called the Stop the Cuomo Tax campaign that's been really promoted heavily by NYPERG and Food and Water Watch, where tens of thousands of people have been signing petitions. And like I said, the legislature has, introduced bills to try to repeal or delay the subsidies that have really, sort of called attention to the fact that this is just a massive corporate bailout and that it really, contradicts the state's clean energy goals.
Well, has Schneiderman, the attorney general of the state, expressed an opinion on this, or has he kept quiet? He's a pretty feisty guy.
He hasn't. And he's kind of bound by the state constitution, which requires him to defend the state government in these lawsuits.
So you are now asking a federal court to overturn.
It's a state court in this case. There are also
state court
challenges to the bailouts in the federal courts as well. But this one is a state court challenge. That basically says that the PSC broke the state law by doing it.
So does the state court have the power to overturn the PSC decision?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the lawsuit is basically, the lawsuit was filed under what's called the State Administrative Procedures Act, which governs how state agencies make decisions. And so it requires things, public notice of major decisions and the kind of time frames that the public has to respond. When you're looking at what makes for good government and what makes for good decision making, that you can't do things, like give a $7.5 billion corporate bailout without the public having an opportunity to weigh in and decide whether this is a good idea. That's really the basis for this is that the PUC or the PSC sort of flew in the face of what are accepted standards for good government.
And has the legislature as a whole, or have any individual legislators weighed in on this?
Yeah, there was actually a tremendous amount of opposition in the state legislature last year. There were multiple bills introduced in both the state assembly and the state senate to delay the implementation of the bailout, until there could be a more thorough public review of it. And, those failed to get enough votes to be passed. But there were public legislative hearings that took place. And there's a tremendous amount of pressure on the governor, over the decision that he made.
Wow. Is there a party line breakup in the legislature? I mean, are Republicans supporting the bailout and Democrats against, or how's that working? Or is it bipartisan?
More or less, yeah. I mean, although, you know, there's the fact that the governor's a Democrat and most of the opposition is from Democrats in the legislature makes it, you know, not quite a party line issue.
And is anybody rising up to oppose Cuomo in the primaries or in the general election that would kill these subsidies?
I mean, there's nothing that could be done right now through the election that would do it. I mean, it's really, you know, it's really based on what's going to happen in the court cases now.
Uh-huh. Okay. And have you got a time frame for the court cases?
We will soon. You know, there's going to the lawyers have to confer and the parties have to agree to a schedule. But, you know, we'll know more about that in about a month or so.
And are you at NEAR as a party to the lawsuit?
We are, yeah. We were involved in the whole, you know, PSC proceeding where the bailout was determined, and we're one of the main parties involved going forward in the lawsuit to stop it.
And there's not much doubt that if the bailout doesn't go through and somehow stop, those reactors are shut.
Well, I mean, it would be really hard. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is now, you know, I mean, tens if not hundreds of thousands of people in New York are aware of what a bad deal this was and have been really upset about it, and, you know, and signing petitions and, you know, going to Albany and calling their legislators and calling the governor's office. If we win in the court, you know, basically what would happen is the court would send it back to the PSC, you know, to have to do over. And I would imagine that at that point, the legislature and dozens of local officials and local communities and hundreds of groups across the state are going to be getting involved in that process. And, it, you know, and so they may not be able to justify doing this bailout over. And if that happens, then these subsidies stop. And, you know, two of the four reactors that were bailed out were already planned to be shut. They already had closure dates when they were supposed to shut down. This bailout reversed those.
Wow.
So, you know, so we would expect that without these, you know, if these subsidies get, you know, get repealed, then those nukes are going to shut down in relatively short order.
Amazing. Well, that's fantastic. Let's hope that happens. I can't imagine. Well, maybe Cuomo will tread water until after the election and then pull out. I mean, I can't imagine how incredibly stupid that is to bail these reactors out. Let's jump down to Georgia. Are you guys following the fight over the Volcker plants? Where do we stand on that?
Well, one thing to say is the Georgia Public Service Commission is sticking to its guns incredibly, despite the example across the border in South Carolina, the cancellation of two identically designed reactors with the same company, Westinghouse, involved. In Georgia, they're sticking to their guns. It was a 5-0 all-Republican Public Service Commission vote just some weeks ago to continue forward. And why not? I mean, the companies involved have no skin in the game. The problem is it's the ratepayers of Georgia who are being gouged on their electricity bills. It's federal taxpayers. Incredibly, the Trump administration, just out of the blue, there was no discussion, just an announcement that $3.7 billion of additional nuclear loan guarantees were being awarded by the U.S. Department of Energy to Vogtle Units 3 and 4, which are less than half built, are years behind schedule, are billions of dollars over budget, on top of Obama's $8.3 billion. Nuclear loan guarantee. So that's an even $12 billion. And that works out to 22 times the amount of money that was lost to the U.S. Treasury in the Solyndra Solar loan default that the Republicans like Fred Upton from Michigan tried to make so much hay about and hang it around Obama's neck, even though George.
Oh, no. I got to have you guys Solyndra. Back. Kevin and Tim, so Kevin Camps, Tim Justin.
That's all.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much. We'll be back again next week in Solartopia. You guys are absolutely great. We'll continue this later, okay? Thank you, Kevin and Tim.